suppose, can we make a start that we are just a little bit past 10. Welcome everyone that I feel really quite excited about today and nervous because I'm trying one or two things that I know a number of people are not happy about, so we'll sort of perhaps test these out. I did want to just actually say at the start that I'm a great believer in serendipity, and in many ways this is, for me, serendipity. I had absolutely no idea I'd ever be asked to be chairman of the Philosophical Society, and I think you made an enormous mistake in having me as chairman. The fact that we're discussing philosophy of science today is of particular interest to me, because as a young architect many years ago in Hampstead, I was listening to a Radio 3 concert, and they had one of those interval talks, which I've usually been fascinated by, and it introduced Karl Popper, and I'd never heard of Karl Popper before. And being at these various philosophy sessions here, I've often wondered why Karl Popper is overlooked. And in having discussions, I've heard various people saying, no, Popper's been rubbished now. Now, in my view, Popper is still very relevant, and I personally reckon there are two things that I pick up from Popper. One is that you can't prove anything, that effectively the best that you can do is put forward a hypothesis which will stand up to testing. And yet so often I hear in this room what seems to me like someone trying to prove something, if A equals B, therefore C, which always leaves me most uncomfortable when I hear that. And I'm wondering if today people will actually demonstrate to me why Popper is wrong on that one. At the moment, I believe Popper is right. The second thing, which for me was very important, was Popper actually demonstrating that scientific progress is made through creativity. As a young architect, I've been brought up in a way of thinking that there might be a scientific way of designing. You go through a logical process and it spits out the answer at the end. And Popper really shows that good scientific progress doesn't come through this way. You actually need an act of creativity. The person trying to solve the problem gets it using the problem, and then actually has to go through a creative process in thinking what an answer might be, and then that is tested through there. So I'm very interested to see if today these two major essences of Popper, as I see it, actually get knocked sideways through on this. So I'm coming into it in an open mind in that way. We have four speakers set up for today that we've agreed in terms of the timetable to keep the speaker sessions very short, of a half hour maximum. Timetable is just 5 minutes at the end of each, really for questions or clarification only, if we can try and avoid discussion at that stage. They're just questions of clarification. So we can get through all four speakers relatively quickly. So this afternoon we can focus on discussion through there. Now, the most contentious part of what I'm suggesting is that we divide into four separate groups. There are about 60 of us. If we divide into four groups, it'll be about 15 each. Because I take the view that this room is an appalling room physically for discussion. I think the process which we normally do, which has to be done when you're dealing with this in the numbers, of queuing to ask the questions, actually is a bad sort of condition for discussion. Now, several people have said to me they're really very, very unhappy about the idea of splitting into different groups. And if there really is a feeling that my proposal of splitting into different groups is going to be uncomfortable and not work, we'll just drop it through there. But see how that goes. Now, we've also, I've actually got the thing here just to split it into groups. But another thing which I've introduced, which again might be a bit contentious, is that Patrick and I were having a conversation a while ago, and Patrick explained that he used to be a professional orchestral player until he had a car accident, so it would be nice to introduce a piece of music. And we've actually arranged at the fair end of the lunch break to have a small musical performance on the stage. There's a grand piano in the cupboard there, which is going to be pulled out. And there's a double bass just waiting outside. And they're going to call it a 10-minute rock piece. But it's during the tail end of the lunch break. If you hate music, just stay outside. So that's really my chairman's introduction. Our first speaker is Trevor Hussey, who is going to give us an overview. Eileen is just reminding me she wants to say a couple of
minutes. I'm Hazel today. Could you please put your hand up if you've ordered the hot veggie lunch? Right. I think you've ordered lunch. I just want to know who the veggies are. Because we always get Let's sit down straight up, please. Right, 1, 2, 3, 4. Several. Some more on the leaflet. Right, okay. And if you're having lunch at all, I've got lunch, can you put your hand up, please? Oh, God. Right. Including the veggies.
To give an introduction and an overview, and then the three speakers to come. It's almost too obvious to say that we live in an age dominated by science. It's not just that our economy and our way of life rests on the products of science and technology. Our whole worldview is infused with scientific outlook. And even if you have no interest in science at all, science still influences the way you see the world. You see the world through science-tinted spectacles. And the least interested in science must be aware of the marvellous successes of science. The popular science books shout at us from the bookshelves about how science has solved our problems and so on. And despite this, I think there have been some disenchantment with science over the last few decades, and turning away from or rejection of the scientific outlook. Now, we can speculate about the causes for that. Blight of industrialisation, even as far back as the Romantics, they were opposed to science for that reason, or feared science. That the threat of the terrible weapons of mass destruction, should they exist, has caused people to resent science or fear science. The rise of technology-based means of bureaucratic control causes some people to fear. The destruction of the environment and so on is often put down to science, the effects of science and technology. Well, whatever the cause is, the symptoms are there. New Age romanticism, alternative therapies, parapsychology, and even in the academic world or intellectual world, the shift towards relativism and postmodernism. At a more practical and perhaps more frightening level, we can see a dramatic decline in young people taking up the study of science, which is very serious. Well, underlying this disenchantment, there's been highly significant changes in the philosophy of science itself. And as I hope to show, there's been a slide from an initial peak of optimism and positive feelings about science down to a much more complicated, uncertain, and sceptical tangle of opinions. And the three contributors that follow will illustrate the complexity of this situation, some aspects of it. So what I want to do now is sketch, a historical sketch of how we got to where we are now. Now the textbooks, the philosophical textbooks, the historical textbooks, usually claim that scientific age began in the 16th century with the work of Copernicus and so on, and gathered pace in the 17th century with figures like Galileo and Tycho Brahe and Harvey and Bacon and Kepler and so on, and then culminated in the magisterial work of Newton in the 18th century and the French Enlightenment. Now, of course, there was an enormous amount of science of a kind that had been done before that. It is surprising when you look back at the Greeks, for example, that Pythagoras was suggesting that the Earth was a sphere, and he even suggested that the seasons result from a tilt in the Earth's axis. Aristarchus suggested that the Earth went round the sun, and Eratosthenes actually measured the circumference of the Earth and got it probably within about 400 miles of the right figure. This is real science. Philosophers like Democritus and Leucippus gave us atomic theory. We have Aristarchus beginning the science of hydrostatics, setting his bar. We've got the works of Aristotle. And of course, a huge proportion of the works of Aristotle are much closer to science than they are to philosophy. There you have his dabbling in physics and meteorology and psychology and biology and so on. And then there were the Arab scholars and the medieval scholars like Edward Ayn and so on, all contributing to science. Nonetheless, by the time we get to the rise of science in the late 16th, early 17th century, much of Greek thought, especially the works of Aristotle, had become tangled up with theology and ossified into this intricate, elaborate structures of scholastic philosophy. And certainly that was the view taken by the first great champion of science, Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626. Now, he railed against Aristotle and against the schoolmen of his day. He despised their intricate chains of deductive reasoning, as if truth could be found by following strings of Aristotelian syllogisms. In his Advancement of Learning, which was published in 1605, he compares them to spiders forever spinning out webs of propositions from within themselves. Bacon's alternative is a thoroughgoing inductive empiricism. If we want to discover truths about the world, we must make observations, we must conduct experiments, we must formulate laws, looking for correlations, we must try to falsify our, or to test our theories by experiment. Now, I just want to insult your intelligence for a while by reminding you of the difference between deduction and induction. I'm sure almost everyone or everyone in this audience knows this distinction, but let me just say, with a deductive argument, you start from propositions, the premises of the argument, and you then show what follows from those propositions, what are contained in the proposition. So all you're doing is unpacking what is in your original statements, and then you reach your conclusion. So all cats are mammals, Tibby is a cat, therefore Tibby is a mammal, is a typical deductive argument. Whereas with induction, you start from particular instances, often observations, which act as the grounds or evidence of your conclusion. And your conclusion goes beyond, in many forms of induction, goes beyond the initial evidence. So from the observation that this piece of water boils at 100 degrees centigrade and that piece of water boils at 100 degrees centigrade, you conclude that all does at that normal temperatures and pressures. So there you have a typically inductive argument. Now, in his work, great work, Novum Organum, Francis Bacon aimed directly at Aristotle's philosophy as laid out in the Organon. And Bacon wanted to sweep this whole worldview away and replace it with this new scientific outlook. What he wanted to rid us of was Aristotle's emphasis on a priori reasoning, on deductive reasoning, and his essentialism, which we shall come to with Peter later. Let me give you an example of Aristotle's deductive, maybe an example you all know, but it's where he's discussing the sex of honeybees. Does everybody know this example? Some of you will, I'm sure. This is in his Generation of Animals, and he's discussing whether honeybees are male or female. And this is the way he says, these are his words translated into English. But again, it is also unreasonable to suppose that bees are female and that drones are male. For nature does not give weapons for fighting to any female. And while drones are stingless, all bees have a sting. Nor is the opposite view reasonable, that the bees are male and the drones are female. For no males are in the habit of working for their offspring. As it is, the bees do this. So you see the way he's working from first principles. He has two principles. One is that weapons are never given to females, and the second is that men don't do any work. Women do all the work. And from those two principles, you go to this. You've got to say, you want to get him by the scruff of the neck and say, look, for goodness sake, don't set the tree. Well, I'm happy to let Peter Gibson talk about the intricacies of modern essentialism, but I will say a little bit about this early Aristotelian form. Aristotle held a form of essentialism, and many of the scholastic philosophers took it up too. Now, Aristotle believed very roughly that each kind of thing, a man, a horse, a pig, it has its own substance, its own peculiar substance. And a substance consists of matter together with form. And now matter itself is undifferentiated stuff, of which all things are constituted. But matter cannot exist without some form or other. And conversely, any given form can't exist without a quantity of matter for it to be the form of. So a man is a unique substance which consists of a quantity of matter plus the form of a man. Now, what this means is that every unique substance must have some kind of essence, a defining characteristic which makes it the thing it is. So a man is an animal like any other animal, but what distinguishes him from the rest of the animals is rationality. Man is a rational animal. So Socrates may have various accidental properties. He has a snub nose and a nagging wife, apparently, but he must necessarily have rationality if he's to be the man Socrates. So science must try to determine what essences there are, or what the essences are of all the different substances that exist. And when it's discovered these essences, it can then deduce from those other facts, other necessary things about those substances. So, for example, if man is to be rational, he must be able to think. And if he is to think, he must be able to use language. Therefore, man must have language. And you can work these things out deductively. Well, it was this view of science that was rejected so vehemently in the 17th century, especially by the empiricist philosophers. John Locke is one of the most, makes one of the most vigorous attacks. And Voltaire, of course, lampooned the theory by explaining the soporific effects of opium by the fact that it contains Virtus Dormitiva. It's his explanation of soporific effects. Well, in other words, what they're accusing Aristotle and the scholastic essentialism of being is an empty verbal game, not science at all. So science has to work by observation, experiment, not by analysing definitions. Well, it's not easy for us to go back into the time of Bacon, into that early time when it was a pre-scientific age, to understand the passion with which Bacon attacked the established outlook. I've got a book here published in, this is the original copy, published in Bacon's time, and I'll try and illustrate what it says. I've got an overhead too. Look at the top part there. As you can see, it's the sum of a disputation between a Mr. Walker, pastor of St. John the Evangelist in Watling Street, London, a Popish priest calling himself Mr. Smith, but indeed Norris, assisted by other priests and papists, held in the presence of some worthy knights with other gentlemen of both religions. It's printed in 1624. Now, that actually was only 4 years after the publication of Bacon's great work, and in fact 1624 is also significant for another reason, because it was the year that Galileo was given permission to submit his heliocentric theory to Pope Urban VIII, and so it's quite an auspicious year. Well, what I'd like to do is just read you a little bit that's at the bottom of that. It's not easy to read, in fact. He says that they've been discussing whether the Church of England is a real church or whether the Catholic Church is the only church. And then he says, "But I fear me that this kind of friar preaching is odious and distasteful to all judicious beholders. I pray you let us dispute orderly and according to art. And if you be able to dispute scholar-like, let us have one argument framed into a short syllogism." Mr. Smith then replies, "I warrant you I can make syllogisms to your small comfort." And then Walker replies, "And I doubt not that I shall as easily answer them to your small ease." And Mr. Smith then, with much ado, uttered his syllogism and caused it to be written down. And the rest of the book, which is not a very long book, admittedly, but the rest of the book consists of framing syllogisms, challenging those syllogisms, and framing another syllogism, and so on. And this was taken to be the model of correct argument. And you can see, you get some sense then of the way in which Bacon just railed against this, that this was never, we were never going to learn about the world by arguing about syllogisms. Well, nonetheless, science slowly crept ahead, and it spread throughout Europe. Progressive intellectuals of the day could see something remarkable was happening. New science was giving us knowledge beyond anything that the ancient Greeks had given us. So it must have been a very exciting time. And by the 18th century, the Enlightenment, science was seen as the hope of mankind. It was going to solve our problems, going to bring unprecedented health and well-being and happiness. Of course, this revolution was not universal. It excited the intellectual elites, but such as the members of the Royal Society and the French Academy, but it didn't probably influenced many of the educated classes of its day, certainly not the church. I've got another book here which is published at the height of the Enlightenment, in fact, 1753.
But you can read that.
Christian's Defense Against the Fears of Death, with seasonable directions on how to prepare ourselves to die well. Okay? By Rondrelincourt. Now, what's remarkable about this book is that it was published in 1756, in fact, at the height of the Enlightenment. And it's the publisher's flair that I like about it, because as a preface, it has this. A true relation of the apparition of one Mrs. Veal the next day after her death to one Mrs. Bargrave at Canterbury, the 8th of September 1705, which apparition recommends the perusal of Drelincourt's Book of Common. Now, you can't get a better sales blurb than that. Well, you can see what a credulous age it was, and these people were working in an age with those kinds of attitudes. But nonetheless, science did slowly prevail, and by the end of the 18th century, I think the scientific outlook dominated much of European culture, and the intellectuals of the day not only embraced the scientific outlook, but they saw it as the salvation of mankind. Now, it would rid us of ill health and, as I said, starvation and suffering and all the rest of it. Now, I think, to summarise that, I'd like to put up some beliefs about science that I think they held. I'll go through these one at a time, so I'll cover them up. I think that what they believed was, first of all, that science gives us knowledge and understanding. It discovers objective truths about the world. In stark contrast to the beliefs and opinions and superstitions of the past, there'll be no more endless disputations about the minutiae of beliefs. We would have certainty, real facts about the world. The second thing I think they believed was that science makes progress. It accumulates knowledge. Instead of a succession of fashions, of cults and systems of belief that they had, science would build fact on fact as a rolling snowball collects snow. And our understanding of the world would progress, not merely change. Third belief is that science has a special method which distinguishes it from all other activities. In other words, science is a device for discovering truth, and it works in a way unlike anything else. And this is why it's been so successful. How else can we explain its success? But we've got this special method. And no other activity has this special method, and therefore, if we can define the method precisely, we can make a clear demarcation between science and non-science. And finally, science is morally neutral. Science is a paradigm of rationality. That's the fourth belief. Science is a paradigm of rationality because its methods are rationally justifiable. In other words, it's intellectually respectable to do science, unlike superstition and religion and mysticism. Once we have identified the proper method, we'll see why it's so successful at gaining truth and avoiding error. And that there need be no wars over scientific truths, as there have been over religious beliefs, because they would be ascertainable rationally. Okay, I'm sorry about that slip. And finally, science is morally neutral. It deals with facts, not values. Obviously, this was very much reinforced by the work of David Hume and his distinction between facts and values and so on, the discussion he made. But in other words, it may be morally good to adopt science because it's going to solve our problems, and the products of science may be morally good or bad, but the method itself is morally neutral. It has nothing to say about values, only about facts. Well, I think these five beliefs that I've got there sum up the peak of optimism and confidence and admiration for science at the end of the 18th century, and it's been downhill ever since, and that's what I want to do. That's what I want to talk about for the rest of my time, which I've got another quarter of an hour, I think, or 10 minutes. What I want to do is to discuss how we got from there to where we are now, and this, I hope, will put the other talks into some sort of context. Let's start off with scientific method. If science has a special method which explains its success, then surely we must be able to say what it is. And if that method can be justifiably could be called rational, then we must be able to describe it with precision. But this has proved much more difficult than these early optimists ever dreamed. There was controversy right from the start, because despite Francis Bacon's persuasive arguments, many philosophers and scientists rejected his empiricism and favoured a rationalist position. I'm not going to go into rationalism and empiricism in great detail, but as you know, for the rationalists, their model was geometry. Science must begin with certain a priori truths taken as axioms, and it must argue deductively from those axioms to arrive at a set of theories or theorems about the world that have the certainty of mathematics. Relying on the vagaries of sense experience is a recipe for error, as far as the rationalists are concerned. Now, the empiricists, people like Bacon, Locke, Berkeley, Hume, argued that knowledge of the world would only come from sense experience, and must achieve. And if we want to achieve certainty, what we must do is just make careful observations and unprejudiced observations, and from them formulate laws about the universe by inductive reasoning rather than deductive. But by and large, the empiricist view dominated, but even here cracks begin to show. You'll remember that Berkeley, for example, who was an empiricist, couldn't bring himself to believe in an external world. He favours idealism, not realism. And even Hume, the arch-empiricist, had to conclude that the material world was really just a convenient fiction which explained our observations. So this is anticipating the instrumentalism that Phil Rees is going to talk about. Now, David Hume convinced most people that the traditional rationalism could give certainty, but only at the cost of telling us absolutely nothing about the world. If you give us necessary truths, but they will be tautological. Unfortunately, he did much the same job on empiricism, because he was able to show that inductive reasoning leads to conclusions that cannot be rationally justified. It always goes beyond its evidence. You move from a finite number of observations to a universal conclusion. So if science uses induction, it cannot claim to be a rational method. Well, nonetheless, the various brands of empiricism, inductive empiricism, were in favour throughout the 19th century, and particularly in Britain with the work of John Stuart Mill and so on. But the horrors of the First World War, as we come up into the 20th century, rekindled the Enlightenment desire for rational reform of what they saw as corrupt and archaic systems of thought. The logical positivists, again, wanted to embrace science as the saviour of mankind. They argued that science was the only genuine source of knowledge. In fact, their verificationist theory of meaning was supposed to show that all other discourse was strictly meaningless. But there's a serious problem with science and scientific realism, which most scientists seem to assume, because scientists will insist on talking about theoretical and unobservable entities, atoms, electrons, photons, magnetic fields, perfect gases, genes, etc., etc. Now, if you allow those unobservable theoretical entities Why not allow cherubim and seraphim, or angels and fairies? Well, for this kind of reason, the logical positivists tended towards instrumentalism, and according to which scientific theories are not descriptions of the world at all. They are merely predictive devices, as Phil will explain. Well, attempts to give a full and convincing account of scientific method culminated in the great work of Karl Popper. He took Hume's problem of induction very seriously and tried to describe a scientific method which avoided inductive reasoning altogether, but without resorting to old-fashioned rationalism. Now, Paul Coburn will describe his famous hypothetical deductive method plus his falsifications and so on, so I won't do that. But here at last, Popper and his followers claim, is an account of scientific method which is both precisely describable and rationally justifiable, because it doesn't use induction. And so it can be used to clearly demarcate between science and non-science or pseudoscience. Well, unfortunately, Popper's great theory began to crumble within a few decades of its publication. Now, I'm disappointed with the chairman. I'm not going to go through all the arguments, but philosophers found many faults with it, despite the fact that many scientists claim that Popper's theory really did sum up what they did. Now, perhaps the most hurtful criticism, as far as Popper was concerned, was that his falsificationism actually ultimately rests on inductive reasoning. After all, why abandon falsified theories unless you believe that on past experience they will continue to be falsified? Why don't you believe in your theories that it's like catching measles, that once they've been falsified once, they're never falsified again? Well, you don't believe that, and you don't believe that because for inductive reasons. So that was a very painful experience. Now, Paul will explain other problems and issues about Popper, but one of the ones that I want to just mention is that a new and even more destructive attack came from the historian of science, Thomas Kuhn, because in effect he argued that the whole idea of the scientific method is a nonsense. The search is a wild goose chase. If you look at the history of science, what you find is that different scientists pursued science in different ways. If science has no particular method, what can we say about its rationality? How can we distinguish it from non-science or pseudoscience if it has no particular method? Well, that's scientific method. You can see the problem that you've got in the scientific method. Let's turn now to scientific knowledge, because there's been a parallel process concerning the claim that science gives us an objective truth about the world, real knowledge and understanding, as opposed to mere belief and opinion. In the time of Francis Bacon, it was plausible to believe that science would simply accumulate more and more facts until we eventually knew all there was to know about the world. But very soon problems began to appear. Scientists began to formulate and defend opposing theories, and purported facts were shown to be mistaken. Okay, planets did go round orbit the sun, as Copernicus said, but not in perfect circles. The light is a stream of corpuscles. No, it's not. It's a wave. Heat is a form of fluid, caloric. No, it's not. It's a form of motion. Burning consists of giving off phlogiston. No, it doesn't. It consists of taking up oxygen, and so on and so on. All these disputes began to appear. And the greatest blow of all, of course, was when Einstein showed that Newton's great theory was not just inaccurate, it was in fact fundamentally mistaken. It had a wrong view of the universe. Well, now, I want to show what this led to. It's a famous argument which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, but I will nonetheless put it up. The pessimistic induction. If you look at, say, cosmology as an example, you can see that we first of all started off with Ptolemy's theory of epicycles and with the everything going around the Earth. And that was proved to be wrong and replaced by Copernicus, who had a heliocentric theory with perfect circles. That was proved to be wrong, and we adopted Kepler's theory of ellipses, elliptical orbits. That was proved to be wrong, and we replaced that with Newton's theory of gravitational forces determining the orbits of planets. That was proved to be wrong and was shown to be the Einstein's theory of general relativity. Now, what prediction would you make about Einstein's theory, given that his theory...
But that's progress.
Well, so science, you see, as I put there, is the practice of systematically basing your beliefs on false theories. That's what science has been. Now, what's rational about that? In what sense does it make progress? I mean, you assume, of course, that there's a big T here, which is the truth. But of course, it might be that end. You don't know. We've no reason, if by inductive reasoning, that we're going in the right direction. So, or at least that's what these pessimists say. Now, you can see that these are terrible problems about scientific knowledge. And soon, other sceptical or relativist arguments gain ground. In particular, the one about unprejudiced observations, because the claim that this was a myth, all observation is theory-based, it's theory-laden. Thomas Kuhn expanded this into the idea that all normal science, normal periods of science, are conducted within a paradigm, and that a certain way of seeing the world or seeing science, and that these paradigms are incommensurable. You can't measure one against the other. Well, what that means is, of course, that you can't conduct crucial experiments to choose between, say, Newton and Einstein. The shift from one paradigm to another is going to be essentially a non-rational process. It depends on sociological and psychological influences. Young scientists see that all career prospects and Nobel Prizes are likely to be in the new theory, and so they shift over to that. Not because they can prove that that theory is right and the old one is wrong. So the suggestion is that values then are at the heart of science, it's not objective and value-free. It's not that science is not accumulation of knowledge, it's a series of fashions. Well, this drift towards relativism seems inevitable, and any form of scientific realism seems indefensible. All five beliefs that I put up there have been seriously challenged, and science is just modern-day theology. And yet, surely, and this is my prejudice coming out now, there must be something wrong here. I mean, how can we deny that we know and understand immensely more about the world than we did in the 16th century? And how can we explain this huge transformation if science is just a collection of opinions and beliefs? To answer these questions, philosophers of science have been casting around for alternative approaches. Instrumentalism, as Phil Rees-Wolf will explain, is one possibility. For some philosophers, such as Ian Hacking and Ron Paré and Nancy Cartwright and Roy Baskar, others have tried to develop versions of realism, and I must declare a preference there. I would go for some realist theory of science in opposition to instrumentalism. Now, ironically, one possibility harks back to dear old Aristotle, who was so roundly dismissed at the beginning of all this, and his essentialism, and Peter Gibson will explain that theory. Okay, well, I've gone up to my time, so I must stop now, but you can see in summary what's happened. We start off with five very reasonable beliefs about science, very optimistic beliefs, and all of them have been challenged, and that's what today is about. We've picked various aspects of it to talk about, but I hope I've shown something of the background to those for this. Thank you.
I, for one, wish to have had much, much more time to talk on this fascinating like that. Trevor actually started late, so we ought to give him a bit more time. We've got half an hour scheduled for coffee. Oh. if there are one or two questions, if I send a clarification, if we could try and avoid the argument now. There's some things here I'd love to have an argument with. Do you have some questions or clarifications?
Could you just go over the reputation?
Yes. Well, there are various objections to Popper's theory of falsificationism. One objection is this problem that it doesn't avoid induction, that in the end falsification rests on induction, because if you falsify theories you're supposed to reject them, but that supposes that falsified theories, having let you down once, will continue to let you down, and that's an inductive argument. So that's a problem for Popper. Another problem is the Dewan Quine problem, and what they pointed out was that when you test a scientific theory against an experiment, you always have to test more than the theory. You have lots of auxiliary hypotheses. In fact, the whole of science, as it were, is beyond the test. And what you could do under in any circumstances is falsify one of your auxiliary hypotheses rather than your theory. You could cling on to your theory. And in many cases, of course, it's rational to do that. If you take, for example, the theory of, say, continental drift, when Wagner, I think his name is Wagner, first introduced that theory, there was very little evidence to support it and all sorts of things against it. But slowly it's become accepted as, since the 60s, it's been accepted as the account of plate tectonics and so on. So it may be rational to hang on to a good theory even when it's been falsified. I'm trying to think of other problems of Popper, but I think the really most serious one is the Kuhn argument. But if you look back at the history of science, scientists simply haven't used Popper's method. In normal science, what you're doing, you don't challenge your major theories. And when you find anomalies, when you find problems with your theories, you put them to one side because your theories are so useful, they're working for you, you stick with them. It's only at the time of paradigm shifts, of major revolutions in science, that you scrap your theories. But you don't do that because of crucial experiments where your theories prove wrong, because they're incommensurable. The two new theories are, the theory and the old theory, are incommensurable. So even there, Popper doesn't, it's not falsificationism even at time of paradigm shift. So what Kuhn is saying is that the science has never used Popper's method, and if you're going to dismiss people like Newton as non-scientists because they didn't use Popper's method, well then it just makes the nonsense of the history of science.
In that last diagram that you put up, if you replace the name of science with the name of philosophers, and put philosophy at the start, not at the beginning.
So I think you want to get the cup of coffee now, don't you? It is true. I mean, philosophical theories are even more. And what's worse about philosophical theories, you really often haven't got good reasons for saying that they're wrong.
But there are various interpretations.
Yes. In my brief introduction, I mean, I've talked about realism, I've talked about rationality, and I've not been able to define any of those things, so I do apologise.
I think this reminds me, with something we ought to move on to. Several people have got less hours. We'll be chancing those. Thank you very much.